Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 848. My name is Camden Busey. I'm in Libertyville, Illinois, the Reformed Forum headquarters. Although I recorded this episode in Greenville, South Carolina. Well, technically, I believe it was in Greer at Harvest Bible Church, but I recently attended the Greenville Seminary Spring Theology Conference and had an absolutely wonderful time, a delightful time, and I recorded two episodes there in between sessions at the conference. Greenville was so kind to provide a room, and you're going to see that in a minute, where I was able to set up the cameras and the microphones and have some podcast discussions while the sessions were going on or in between sessions. First off, I want to say thanks to Greenville Presbyterian Theological Seminary. It was so kind of them to invite Reformed Forum to come and to organize and really set up a pre-conference event. So in advance of the conference, for the morning of when the conference began, I was able to lecture, providing a biblical theology of the nations. So speaking about the missions, Great Commission, and God's plan, his unfolding plan for including the nations in his blessing through Jesus Christ. Jim Cassidy lectured on the significance of word ministry and particularly preaching in missions. And then Tony Curto spoke about the importance and the significance of teaching in the Great Commission, particularly applied to foreign missions. We had a great time. It was wonderful. I couldn't be more thankful for Greenville for offering us that opportunity. And then their welcome. We met so many people and continue to develop our relationship with friends that we've been, relationships we've been building and strengthening for the last 5 years. And we're thankful for the opportunity to be able to speak and then to record some of these podcasts. Head on over to reformedforum.org. We've recorded quite a few in advance episodes, so sometimes the news and information is a little bit out of sync when I record episodes in advance. There's all sorts of interesting things that have come out recently. We've published a new book on Cornelius Van Til and his ethics. Scott Hatch has written a book on Van Til's ethics, and that book includes a critical edition of Christian Theistic Ethics at the end of it. So you're going to want to get a hold of that because that's a great contribution to scholarship. Not only is Scott's book interesting and thoughtful, talking about Van Til's ethics, but also the book includes a never-before-seen critical combined edition that includes marks and notes on all the different iterations of Van Til's Christian Theistic Ethics syllabus and book. There's also other things going on at Reformed Forum. We're publishing new courses. We've got new events scheduled and lined up. So you can find information on all this at reformedforum.org. Sign up for the email newsletter. It's an easy way for you to stay updated. And every week we'll send you a succinct update that usually includes information about the new podcast episodes, but also all of the things going on. So take a look there for current information. Well, let me introduce to you today, our guests. I was able to sit down at Harvest Bible Church during the Greenville Conference with Zachary Groff. You may know Zach Groff. He's been on PresbyCast many times. Zach is pastor of Antioch Presbyterian Church in Woodruff, South Carolina. He's a graduate of Temple. I went to Temple for one class, so we're both owls of a sort, although I don't have a degree from Temple University, but he also graduated with an MDiv from Greenville, and he's working on a PhD at Highland Theological College, the University of the Highlands and Islands, and has been serving at Antioch Presbyterian Church since 2021, and he's also very involved in the Confessional Presbyterian Journal, as you will hear in this episode. And along with Zach, we welcome Dr. Scott Cook to speak as well and to interact on some issues that are covered in the Confessional Presbyterian Journal. Scott is visiting professor of apologetics at Greenville Presbyterian Theological Seminary. He's also the pastor of Oconee Presbyterian Church in Seneca, South Carolina. In the past, he has served as visiting professor of cultural apologetics and Christian worldview at Erskine College in Due West, South Carolina. I thoroughly enjoyed my conversation with both Zach and Scott. I hope you do as well. It was a wonderful, fun time. And we want you to check out Greenville at gpts.edu, especially get information on their upcoming events. And stay tuned for some things that might be coming in the pipeline, down the pike in the future. But this conversation was great. And we checked out and talked about the Confessional Presbyterian Journal. You're definitely going to want to get a copy, a new copy of the journal. You can find information on that as well at gpts.edu. Let's head over now to this previously recorded conversation with Zach Groff and Scott Cook. Well, we are at Heritage Bible Church in Greer, South Carolina. I'm here at the Greenville Presbyterian Theological Conference. And we have a wonderful setup. For those who are only listening to the podcast, no doubt you might hear that we're in a different sounding room. I need a little bit of sound treatment here compared to our studio. I can hear the echo, and I know that's going to come through the mic. So we'll do as best we can to clean this up. And we have thankfully been given an adult table, because when I first came into this room, we were horsing around, and Greenville has rolled out the red carpet for us. We are so thankful to be here as Reform Forum and to have an opportunity to do a lot of podcasts. We hosted a kind of a joint pre-conference event yesterday morning. The seminary has been tremendously gracious to us. They even gave us this room at the church where we can come and record and set up not only the microphones, but the cameras. But when we did come in, it is the three-year-old room. So all of the tables are shin high. The seats are even lower, obviously. And I asked Pat, I said, hey, you think we can get an adult table? Because if I put, can you imagine bringing in Ian Hamilton or Jonathan, so tall, Jonathan Master, hey, could you come in here and sit down? And we're one step up from squatting on the floor, right? You sit at the little kid's table. And then the microphone's so low that it's pointed at your belly, you know, whatever. So we got it all set up and we're here. I couldn't be happier to be speaking with my friends that I come and visit with at least every year, but then we see each other also at PCA General Assembly and at other places on the conference circuit. But I have with me, we have Zachary Groff and Scott Cook. Brothers, would you introduce yourselves? And we'd love to welcome you here to Reform Forum in Christ the Center. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, it is a joy to be here, Camden, and what a privilege it is to be on the program today to talk about something that we all love, Confessional Presbyterianism, and perhaps the flagship journal of Confessional Presbyterianism in the United States, maybe the only journal on Confessional Presbyterianism as such in the United States, but it is great to be here, Camden. Thank you for having us on.
Exactly. Now, for a long time, you worked at Greenville, but now you're at Antioch PCA, is that correct?
Yeah. I didn't know how much you wanted me to go into that, but I, for 6 years, was Director of Advancement and Admissions at Greenville Seminary, much of which time I was also an MDiv student.
Yeah.
And after I graduated, I started a slow transition out of my role at the seminary to go into full-time pastoral ministry and blessedly not too far from the school. So I co-pastor Antioch Presbyterian Church with Dr. Piper, Dr. Joseph Piper, who is known to your listeners, I'm sure, and is still full-time on faculty at the school. And I'm the full-time pastor. He's the part-time pastor. And it's been...
Are you sure to remind him of that or what?
Notice I did not use senior or associate. I have a funny story about that. This is a long-form podcast, so I can share it. But we had a session meeting last year, and I made a motion, which, since he was moderating that meeting, he ruled it out of order, unfortunately. But I made a motion that we change his title to Associate for Family and Youth, since I was going full-time at the church. And he laughed and ruled it out of order. And so anyway, we're both pastor of the church. It's a church plant. We have a borrowed session.
Yeah.
Hopefully this year, even maybe the Lord will... hear our prayers and answer them and raise up elders and deacons from within the growing congregation.
Amen.
So things are going well there, which is why I'm putting down roots as a full-time minister there. But my time at Greenville was fantastic.
Yeah.
And as I was leaving, I made a humble request to Dr. Master and to Mr. Daly. And I said, you know, I would love to continue being involved with just one thing formally, and that is the Confessional Presbyterian Journal. Mm-hmm. And the general editor, Chris Caldwell, was amenable to that as well. And so allowed me or invited me, however you want to put it, to remain on as managing editor. And that puts me in a position where I get to reach out to friends and scholars and request submissions to the journal and then do a lot of the editing work as well. And Chris and I have had a blast putting this journal, this volume together, as well as the previous two. And we're even working on this year's already. I'm sure we'll get into some of that during the podcast.
Amen. Thank you. And Scott, you teach at the seminary, part-time adjunct or full professor, but I know you're also serving as a pastor as well.
Yeah, that's right. So I serve full-time as the pastor of Oconee Presbyterian Church. It's about an hour west of the seminary. And so I'm also part-time in the seminary as an apologetics professor. And let me just say, I'm so grateful to be able to be on the podcast with you here. I've been listening to and benefiting from Reform Forum since I think shortly after y'all were originally Wittenberg Castle Door.
Even before we were Reform Forum.
So since my college days, it's just such an honor and privilege to be able to be here with you, and especially talking about, you know, the Confessional Presbyterian Journal, which I think has such a unique offering in the world of scholarly journals, and talking about the PCA and its heritage and history and future. It's just really an honor to be here with you. But those are the ministries that I serve at as a full-time pastor and then as a part-time professor of apologetics.
We love that. We love your Vantillian interest and convictions and carrying on that tradition at Greenville. For those who may not know, Scott came up and visited us when we concluded the Van Til curriculum, the Fellowship in Reformed Apologetics that Lane Tipton taught. We have 8 courses on Van Tilian apologetics and theology, and now he's moving on and teaching other things through Reformed Academy related subjects. But we have a discrete curriculum of 8 courses going through all sorts of different loci, loci in Vantillian concerns. And so when we were going to conclude that, we wanted to make a big deal of it. We had met Scott at previous conferences, and we knew of his interest in Vantill and invited him to come up. So thanks for making the trip. But we had a great time. That was just last April. So it's about a year ago. And we knocked off that curriculum. We recorded the final course, and we're able to spend a lot of time with Scott and Lane, and Ryan Noah was there. It was a really, really fun time. We really enjoyed
it. Was.
And Sergey, do you remember Sergey? Sergio.
Yes. Sergio. Right. Sergio.
We went to a restaurant and Sergio was taking care of us. He was kind of like sommelier, clown, kind of like
all wrapped into one. So, a great experience.
I wanted to take my wife back there to that restaurant for our 20th anniversary coming up. It closed. Oh, so now I got to find where Sergio's working, because I definitely want to be taken care of by Sergio. Also part used car dealer.
Right.
Oh, man. So was it more of a Sergio or a Sergio? You know, like, how was it?
Well, it gets better, because I said Sergey because he presented himself as an Italian sommelier. He was trained in Italy, but he goes on and on about this. And we're like, this does not sound Italian.
No, not
at
all.
He says his name is Sergio, and he's talking about his time in Italy and all this stuff as he's describing to us the food and the wine. This is at an Italian kind of restaurant. Mm-hmm. It was a nice restaurant. We're thankful for that. But we wanted to celebrate the moment of finishing this whole curriculum. He goes on and on. And then the waitress who was taking care of us was wonderful. The service was excellent, but she clearly was Russian, and Sergio had seemed Russian to me. he had done a lot of taking care of whatever. He had done a lot to kind of be a little bit more vague in terms of where he was from and all this.
He was really trying.
He was really trying to be more of a cosmopolitan, I think.
But he had an angle.
And he realized that you may not take the sommelier as seriously if he's a Russian guy. You'll take him seriously on vodka recommendations, maybe, not on wine. Well, we asked the waitress, and that's about Sergio. He's from Italy. She's like, no, he's not from Italy. He's from, and then she lists off this small town in Russia. He goes, well, but he said he was trained there. She goes, well, that might be true. We knew this guy was the best, and service was great, but we were like, all of his recommendations and all the facts he was given about the things, like, they were doing internet searches. They just weren't, none of this was lining up. Right?
Oh, man.
But it didn't matter. Because this is where the lights really turned on for me. The power of
the entertainment angle to the hospitality industry, yep. because I knew this guy was spinning, he was telling a story, spinning mm-hmm. a yarn and doing the thing. And even though we knew he was doing all this stuff and he's like, you know, I'm sorry. I know that last one I recommended was a bit out of your budget, but let me tell you, I don't do this for people normally, but I've got this really special one.
There like, it is.
He's doing all this stuff. Yeah. And we knew the game he was playing the whole time. And I didn't care because it was so funny. He was so good at it that it was fun. I don't know what moral to this story is, what this has to do with anything we're talking about today, other than it was a memorable time.
That it was.
And I'm trying to track this guy down because I want to go back and find whatever restaurant he's at because I want to go for the ride again. It was so fun. Oh, anyway. Man. I guess the fact that we know it's over and done and closed, maybe that makes that one moment we were there doing that even more special. Who knows that you can't repeat it. Anyway, so today we're talking about the Confessional Presbyterian Journal, a very special journal. My colleague Ryan Noah, I love it too, but he was saying, this is the only one that matters. You know, as Ryan does, he's like, this is the only one. I don't care about any journal. Why read them all? Any of them. But this one is the one. I got to read it all. They're doing stuff that matters. And it's true. You know, he's not wrong. I mean, there are other journals that I've received and some I've let my subscription lapse. Others I keep on maybe for sentimental reasons or because I'm a completist and I have to collect the set or whatever. But so often I get them and I look and there's nothing I want to read in this. But so often when we pick up copies of the Confessional Presbyterian now in its 19th issue, 2023, what originally started as something maybe looking to do 2, 3, 4, or 5 and have a nice little complete set has now gone for 19 years. Often you read this and I don't know which one to read first because there are so many articles in there that are dealing with real life issues in the church, but doing so with seriousness and trying to blend, you know, it's a true pastoral scholarship, trying to do what ought to be done. And live up to its name, the Confessional Presbyterian Journal. So I'm excited today to talk about this. Zach, could you tell us about this issue specifically? And, you know, that's a great opportunity here in December. It was the celebration of the PCA's 50th anniversary. And you're featuring lots of articles on the subject and even have the custom artwork. We're wondering who's going to be on the portrait. And you fit like 50 people.
That's right, Kevin. I mean, you put your finger right on the issue of what it is we were trying to accomplish with this particular volume of the Confessional Presbyterian Journal. So those who are familiar with the journal or those who just even look it up online will...
One up for everybody.
There's this year's volume and all of its beauty. But on the back, you'll see portraits of individuals. Yeah. That's usually what the cover looks like. Not a group of individuals, but just one individual as the feature subject, at least of the cover, and usually of several of the featured articles within the actual volume itself. And this year, we were going back and forth about whom to feature on the cover. And I forget who it was that made the recommendation that we do something that ties into the PCA's 50th anniversary. Yeah. But it was one of us at the seminary. And then somebody else had the idea, why don't we feature a scene from the first GA? Because we knew we had photographic scenes from both the Convocation of Sessions in May of 1973, but also the First General Assembly in December of 1973. And we found a suitable picture, which is actually on the inside front cover, the actual photograph. Mm-hmm. I don't know how well you can see that on the video version of the podcast, but that was the basis then for the artistic rendition, which has, you know, some alteration of some details on the front. And Mike Mann is our resident artist.
Yeah, he's tremendous.
He doesn't reside in South Carolina. He resides in New Mexico. But Mike does a wonderful job for us each year. And as long as he's painting, I know the seminary is still engaged with him to do the portraits for us and for this one, the live scene. So we got that depiction of a scene from the First General Assembly. We're not sure exactly where in the business they were at that point, but it is an action shot from a parliamentary procedure at the birth of the PCA. And most of the articles that we have, if you look at the table of contents, most of the articles that we have are obviously tied into the history of the PCA and some of our sister denominations, particularly in terms of our relationships with those other denominations. And I say we because I am, Scott and I both are ordained teaching elders in the PCA. I had the privilege of writing the anchor article, Obedient to the Great Commission, the Presbyterian Church in America at 50, in which I spent a little bit of time talking about the formation of the PCA, but that story's been told competently and many times over by the likes of Morton Smith and Frank Smith and Sean Lucas and other historians. And so I wanted to take a closer look at the first 50 years of the PCA as such. And the only other work I know of that does that for the first 50 years is David Hall's new book, Irony, in the Presbyterian Church in America. And Ryan Beese wrote a great review of that for this journal as well. And I drew from Dr. Hall's work. Beyond that anchor piece, I think, I haven't counted it up, but we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and you might be able to count Dr. Van Duderwerd's piece as well, 9 articles specifically about concerns that are central to the PCA, and then 2 more, one, again, my second article on the framework hypothesis, and then Jacob Gerber's piece on scriptural ethics through William Perkins that tie into some big concerns in the PCA, our debates about creation doctrine, but then also Jacob Gerber was really looking at what it means to be faithful to the scriptures, even from a pastoral scholar kind of perspective. Mm-hmm. And so that is more than any other issue we've ever done. That really is an integrated whole for the theme. And Chris Caldwell, the general editor, says, And you know, he was just sharing with me privately, and I think I mentioned this on in a few conversations, but he said that this has been, in his mind, not just the largest issue of the Confessional Presbyterian, but also the best, and in terms of being integrated with all the subject theme, the cover theme. So I've really enjoyed working on it and just poring over these articles and helping guys get their material ready for publication. Man, what a privilege that has been. And so that's a little high level kind of view of at least what's in the journal. I'm happy to answer any other specific questions.
Well, we can certainly dive in, but Scott, I'd love for you to talk a bit about how you came to this particular issue and your interest specifically in the Standing Judicial Committee, because you've written
commission.
An article. Commission.
Yes.
I'm sorry. Of course. That's a very important distinction. I miss
indeed.
Standing Judicial Commission. That makes all the difference. But you talk a bit about the history of that and how it came to be. But even behind that, how did you come to write that article but actually end up in this issue?
Yeah, so I've had the privilege a couple of times to contribute to the Confessional Presbyterian. And with this one, well, it was Zach who reached out to me saying that it was going to be on the 50th anniversary of the PCA, and was there anything that I had in mind? And I'm someone who, for better or for worse, is kind of a parliamentarian at heart. I tell my ruling elders I don't understand why people don't read Robert's Rules of Order at least once a year. So I confess I'm that sort of guy. So when he mentioned that to me, the thought immediately came into my mind, both in terms of an interest that I'd always had, but also thinking in the spirit of the Confessional Presbyterian continuing what the 19th century Presbyterian journals were doing, which was not just a journal for the academy and also the church, but really for the church and also the academy. What article would be helpful to kind of look over a particular feature of PCA polity? And what I initially wanted to do was to do a broad overview of the history of the jurisprudence and the development of the polity of the PCA with regard to discipline. And as I got into that, and Zach knows from being the editor, my article went through a couple of different iterations where I just had to keep cutting because I kept running into so many interesting issues. And I finally narrowed down on the issue of the development of the Standing Judicial Commission. And as you look at any sort of anniversary, I think anniversaries are good times both to celebrate and reflect. And I think the PCA should be celebrated for coming out of the PCUS and being serious about trying to do discipline according to the Word of God. It's also a time of reflection for us to ask, where did we begin? How did we get to where we are? And perhaps what should the last 50 years and a reflection on it mean for the future? So as I started looking at the Standing Judicial Commission in particular, I think that's one area where for guys in my age range and Zach, we're both in our 30s, we grew up in broad evangelicalism or in the PCA, with the PCA always having a Standing Judicial Commission, which for those who are not familiar with PCA polity, mm-hmm. we have a group of teaching and ruling elders who are elected on a class system, I think a 4 or 5 year cycle. And they are a commission so that any judicial matters coming up before the assembly automatically go to them for final adjudication.
Right.
And that was just kind of a feature of the PCA my whole time of being in or involved with the PCA. But if you look at the PCA as it was founded, it was really a grassroots denomination. And so it kind of raises the question, well, how does a grassroots denomination that is very concerned about discipline end up being really, to my knowledge, the only denomination in NAEPARC or the Reform world that has a body that is delegated to do the work of discipline at the General Assembly level. Hmm. And so I just wanted to kind of see, how did this come about? Because that wasn't in the PCA in its original formulation. It wasn't there for the first 13 years they began speaking about at that time. And when I got into doing research on that, I found that it was a story full of twists and turns, a bit of drama. I mean, as much as, yeah, you know, church sure. courts can have in sure. terms of the development of it. I found it to be a really fascinating story that reflected kind of the changing ethos and the growth and development of the PCA. So it's fairly narrowly focused on the story of the development of the SJC, but it also kind of fits into the broader narrative of the growth and development in the first 50 years of the PCA.
Mm-hmm. That's exciting. Let's dive into that in a minute. I'd like to get the larger context for the moment, because Zach's article speaks about the PCA's, you know, anniversary at 50, but also looking back and its relation to the larger mission of the church. Your title is Obedient to the Great Commission. There's a lot of overlap with what we're talking about this week. This whole Greenville conference is on missions, and the pre-conference, we were specifically looking at the Great Commission. But looking back at these grassroots foundings, a lot of people listening might know generally about the formation of the PCA and how it came about. If you don't, pick up especially some of the books that are out there. There are several books that are useful. Sean Michael Lucas's book is really helpful on that specific issue. But if you want to see kind of an overview, at least one person's perspective on the developments in the PCA, looking at each General Assembly, as Zach already mentioned, you can check out David Hall's book. And we did an interview with him on that a couple weeks ago, which was really fun. Talking to David Hall is really fun.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you can't go wrong on that. So, Zach, let's lay a bit of a foundation, if we can, and lead on into Scott's article and the specific issue of the SJC. But what ought we to know, or what listeners or viewers, what should they know just in order to provide the context of those early days in the late 60s, early 70s, leading up to 73, and you mentioned the first 13 years even before there was an SJC.
That's right.
What was going on?
The SJC was founded, I think, at the 17th General Assembly in 1989, but the conversation about it had started sooner throughout the 80s, and I'll get into that. You already mentioned this interesting term, which is unique to the PCA and American Presbyterianism, and that is grassroots Presbyterianism. Some guys, you know, I'm from Philadelphia, so this is all new to me, but some guys down here in South Carolina call it states' rights Presbyterianism, because it's not so much that power is at the congregational level, but that power really resides at the presbytery as opposed to the General Assembly. So some ways that manifests itself, this impulse to keep things local or regional rather than nationally centralized, manifest themselves in the early years of the PCA in certain ways. One is a failed attempt at ratifying a constitutionally binding directory for public worship. There's a real sense that churches and presbyteries should be able to have jurisdiction over how the church as the church worships. And so various attempts to ratify the Directory for Public Worship, which we have one but it's not constitutionally binding. To ratify it as constitutionally binding fail throughout the first 15 years of the PCA or so. And then another way that this manifests itself is actually what leads to the formation of the highly centralized SJC, ironically, and that is the failure to introduce a delegated assembly and a real commitment to opening up participation in the General Assembly as widely and broadly as you can. So every teaching elder in the PCA can attend General Assembly as a commissioner.
Yep.
And then every church in the PCA gets at least two ruling elder commissioners that they can send. And then depending upon how large the church is, you can add more. So we the most we've ever had at a PCA General Assembly ever is about 2,300, I think, 2,300 or 2,400, right?
Yep.
And but we could conceivably have, this is going to blow your mind, Candace, if you haven't heard this one, we could have 10,000 commissioners if every single teaching elder and every single church sent its eligible allocation of ruling elders to General Assembly. Wow. It's that amazing. I mean, how in the world could you have an efficient deliberative assembly with that many? But I mean, be that as it may, we've never even come close to 10,000, but we have hit 2,400 or 2,300. So that's another example of our grassroots impulse. So the failure to have a delegated assembly, though it's been attempted, failure to ratify a constitutionally binding directory for public worship. And then the third thing that is seen particularly up until the RPCES comes in, the Reformed Presbyterian Church Evangelical Synod comes in our joining and receiving in 1983, particularly up to that point, really 1981, I think, all of the agencies of the church had their headquarters in different cities across the South. And it was, it absolutely was intentional to keep things decentralized. So it's not that the agencies were overseen by the presbyteries. They were still overseen by the General Assembly, but they weren't allowed to be housed together. Now, that changes, I think, 1981. I mean, I haven't read my article recently, after we finish it, I move on with my life. But I think it was 1981, maybe, where they finally tasked the stated clerk's office, so Dr. Smith's office, with looking into what it would take, what it would look like. And it was like the next year that they started centralizing the offices in Atlanta area. And so that's just a very interesting physical manifestation of it. But it begs the question, why? Why? And this is where Dr. Smith, both Dr. Smiths, Morton Smith and Frank Smith, and Dr. Lucas open up this story that explains where this grassroots Presbyterian impulse comes from. And it's because of the abuses of a centralized system in the PCUS, which are very similar, though about 40 years later, than the abuses of a centralized ecclesiastical power in the Northern Church, which is what Machen dealt with. And there's a lot of parallels and similarities, though differences of scale and personality, between the stories of the formation of each. But the result, the end result, I would say in the OPC is a carrying over of the centralized Presbyterianism of historic Presbyterian polity. Whereas in the PCA's example, it's actually a significant departure from historic forms of Presbyterianism to produce something that is really unique to the, what we call the historic polity of the PCA.
It's true.
But that actually is what leads to the formation of the SJC. I make that argument very briefly in my article, and I know Scott does as well, and so does David. It's an ironic thing in that because you have this massive assembly, it becomes so unwieldy and inefficient, particularly in this area, the deliberations surrounding judicial cases and appeals that reach GA. So throughout the 80s, you begin to see in the minutes even a fatigue with dealing with more and more judicial cases and trying to be scrupulous and conscientious, but also just getting through the business. And the solution that this grassroots assembly comes up with isn't a delegated assembly that can operate more efficiently. It's actually the formation of a standing, that is permanent, judicial commission on, again, as we said, members of which are elected on a class system.
So. Yeah. there's so many things to comment there. And I appreciate that. It was a very clear and compelling synopsis. Just to put a different spin on it, not because I think it was unclear, but just to say similar things from another angle for the people who might not have caught everything that you mentioned.
Sure.
Before, even before that, there are similarities with the CRC and the URCNA as well, because they're reacting to the decentralization and the bureaucracy of the CRC. The United Reformed Churches in North America, they make a big deal about the fact that it is a federation,
yep,
and that it is a group of churches. And there are some, not, I don't know how many, and I don't even know if it's that many, but there are some who will really bristle at the use of the word church to refer to the denomination or to refer to each classes.
Yeah.
So there's this much more of an emphasis and a tendency on each individual congregation coming together in unity, but the emphasis is it's very decentralized. And that leads to various decisions polity-wise and making things work. But what you explained so clearly, though, people might not realize that other churches, well, at least in the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, each presbytery elects a certain number of people to serve as commissioners to the General Assembly.
Delegates.
Delegate. Yep. Well, ours are commissioners.
Oh, do you call them commissioners?
Oh, yeah. And we make a difference.
Okay.
Yeah. So they're commissioners to the Assembly.
Mm.
And some people might make a fine distinction on that, but the way I define it, and I'm not saying this is official, but other people will share my view. In some parliaments or parliamentary systems, a delegate is sent to do the will of those who send him.
Mm. Yes. Yeah,
whereas a commissioner is elected and sent, but he is voting his own conscience.
Right, right.
And so we make that distinction where you're not bound to do what your presbytery urges you to do, like some delegates in the, I mean, this doesn't really work necessarily this way in the U.S. government, but in the past, sometimes those delegates that go to these, you know, their committee or their party assemblies are, they're bound to vote the way that the people voted in the general election.
Yep.
Some aren't, but some are. So we don't do it that way. So we make that distinction. At least that's how I,
you know, I'm glad you brought that up, because this is a pressing issue today in the PCA. I've heard in various presbyteries discussion as, and we're getting into the weeds here, but it's useful for illustrating what you're talking about, Camden. In various presbyteries of the PCA, there has been discussion that on this question, if we nominate a man to serve as our representative on the General Assembly's nominating committee, which then presents the slate to the GA upon which they vote for men to serve on our permanent committees, for our program committees and agencies and the SJC. The question is, if we as a presbytery nominate this person, are we able to bind him to vote in a particular way?
Right.
And the overwhelming response to that question is no. Mm-hmm. You're not electing him as a delegate in the sense that you just described. You're electing him as a commissioner.
Mm-hmm.
You're entrusting him to involve himself in the deliberations and to make a judgment, to cast a vote, a selection on his conscience, informed by the deliberations, of course.
Yeah.
And so
if you don't like what that guy's going to decide or the way he thinks, then don't elect him.
Exactly. And the issue is, you know, in a true deliberative body, we all go into it thinking we're probably going to go one way or the other. I mean, if you're informed and prepared, but we all go into it open to being persuaded.
You should.
Mm-hmm. And so it's not always predictable what a particular man is going to decide in the moment, in the heat of deliberation. But you're appointing him to that task, electing him to that task, commissioning him to that task, trusting that he will be fair-minded and will give a hearing to all sides, and make a judgment that that accords with godliness insofar as he's able. So I think that's an important distinction to make. I'm glad you made it. And it's one that we revisit this conversation, even in the PCA, informally and sometimes formally as well within our courts.
I think that's an important point. So in commissioning or delegating or sending representatives who are free to vote according to their own conscience, but it functions more like the House of Representatives in the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, in that larger presbyteries receive more people they can send. Mm-hmm. But then you send your people. It ends up being the assembly is capped at a certain number, but the ballpark will be about 150 people at the General Assembly. And they deal with all the business of the assembly. There's the first day of the assembly is dealt with advisory committees, But still, those advisory committees only offer recommendations. They deal with the nuts and bolts details, some of the heavy lifting, but at the end of the day, they just report to the General Assembly. They give recommendations, or they say the committee is silent, which in our assembly rules and descriptions means they're in general agreement. They have no issues to raise. And then the assembly moves on and usually approves their recommendations. But if somebody doesn't like their recommendation, or if there's something thornier, the assembly as a whole deals with every issue, even every disciplinary issue. That's possible. Sometimes it doesn't seem possible, but because the assembly is limited to roughly 150 people, which I'm of the opinion you really can't do an effective deliberative body any larger than that. You're probably maybe over the limit at 150. It's very difficult, especially if you have a lot of people that want to talk a lot.
You certainly can't do it in 3.5 days. And no, you all meet for like 2 weeks, right?
Week and a half, 2 weeks, yes. Yeah. It's getting longer. But we see we cut it down. We spent a long time to cut a day out of the schedule, the general schedule. Yeah. And now we're looking at maybe having to add that day back because things are slowing down.
I've attended OPC General Assemblies, just two in my time. One time representing Greenville Seminary, and then one time before I moved to South Carolina. And it was near Philadelphia, so I went and visited. And I'll tell you this, I love conscientious presbyters, and the OPC is a haven of conscientious presbyters. And so I really admire the scrupulosity, if we can use that word. If it's not even a word, I think it is a word, but
it is now.
I really do admire how seriously the men who attend the OPC General Assembly take their task. Mm-hmm. And I mean, down to the point where you were reviewing the minutes, and I think I won't name him because that's improper in parliamentary procedure, but this is a compliment to him, not a dish, but a certain high profile OPC presbyter got up and was making corrections from the floor on things like semicolons and m-dashes.
They probably told him, go make your marks over on the side.
Well, it was just a couple, and he's referencing the line, and I was sitting in my little exhibitor booth in the little hallway, and I just thought, wow, good for him.
Yeah.
I love the attention to detail. It really is. And that's just one little superficial example of a bigger pattern in the OPC of really being concerned. Now, I think that in the PCA, we are concerned about doing things decently and in good order as well. We have the same life averse, but it definitely manifests itself, expresses itself differently. So usually in that case, someone might rise to make a motion to empower the clerk or his office to make typographical corrections.
Well,
or
we
something
do that
like
too.
That.
We put it off. The clerk reminds people, if you have typos or this kind of stuff, there's copies over there. Go mark them up, and then we'll fix them.
So, yeah, exactly.
I made that error once because I pointed out a typo in my first General Assembly as a commissioner. And they're politely reminded me, if it's of that nature, we understand. Just go over there and do that over there. You don't need to spend our time on that.
I love it.
But what I noticed in my first General Assembly for the Presbyterian Church in America, I went and at least saw part of, explain to me what the official title is, but the Overtures Committee. And that in many ways looked and felt like what the OPC General Assembly often is in terms of size, the way it functioned. And that is a body that's deliberating all sorts of details.
Yep. Mm-hmm. It is. The Overtures Committee, used to be called Bills and Overtures, is something of a delegated assembly within the assembly. Mm-hmm. Each presbytery gets two commissioners, one teaching, one ruling elder, that that each presbytery can send to the Overtures Committee. And those men meet a bit earlier and throughout the day on Monday, going over the various overtures that are referred to it. So what happens is throughout the year, presbyteries consider and pass proposals, which we call overtures, to the General Assembly, and then the stated clerk is tasked with routing them to the appropriate committees. And the Overtures Committee is one such committee. They handle the lion's share of our overtures, particularly those which deal with proposals for constitutional amendment or making some kind of statement on behalf of the assembly or as the assembly, I should say. And I really appreciate the work those men put in. I mean, that's probably the special committee. It is called special committee. The special committee that gets the most attention at at the General Assembly. Everyone wants to know what's going on in Overtures Committee.
What did they say? You know, what are they recommending? So to close the loop on this before we get into the SJC specifically, because of the PCA's founding and ingrained interest and commitment to being grassroots, you've mentioned this, that every teaching elder can come and every church can send up at least two elders. If they're larger, they can send more ruling elders.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I need to correct myself amongst you guys.
No, you're fine.
In the OPC office yet.
Yeah. Yet. Okay.
So you've got everyone there and you just can't conceivably deal with an entire discipline case, a whole slate of discipline cases with 2,000 people in the room, mm-hmm. all with privilege of the floor and voting rights. You cannot do it. It will not work. So
there are various reasons why, one of which is just how unwieldy it is.
Yeah.
But also, and this is something that's becoming more of a hot button issue for us, a desire to be appropriately discreet, to protect victims of abuse or mishandling in the courts, to protect them from getting their name and situation put out there, but also to protect those who are alleged of committing abuse, which perhaps they didn't commit. You know, I mean, that's the whole purpose of a trial, is to get to the bottom of what happened and to administer appropriate discipline. And so there is a real commitment I appreciate about this, about the PCA. I've never sensed that there's a desire to remain secretive, but there is a commitment to being appropriately discreet. And I think that that is good. And the SJC as a mechanism, as an instrument of the GA, does help to protect, you know, discretion and, mm-hmm. and the interest in discretion, you know, and we don't do it perfectly. Nobody, no church does, no organization does, but I applaud the effort and the value commitment that mm-hmm. is behind that. You know, something else I should mention, Dr. Pipa would give me a hard time if I didn't. Mm-hmm. One of the premier ways in which the PCA's grassroots Presbyterianism reveals itself is in this phenomena we have called the Committees of Commissioners. And so each permanent committee, the men who are elected by the GA to serve out a term for, say, Mission to North America, Mission to the World, Covenant Seminary, Covenant College, and RUF, and so on, each one of those permanent committees has a shadow committee. You know, and maybe in the English parliamentary system, you call them backbenchers or something, but you have committees of commissioners, which are elected by their presbyteries to provide additional oversight of the work of the permanent committees.
That's and what our advisory committees do.
Exactly.
Except the stated clerk decides who's on those every year.
Yeah. So the stated clerk does not decide who's
on
those.
Do they persist throughout the year, or is it just at the assembly?
It's just at the assembly.
It's just like our advisory committees.
And they meet at the assembly. They report at the assembly. Sometimes they'll have the committee silent, as in we second all the recommendations of the permanent committee, not formally second, but basically we approve of all those recommendations. Other times they'll say, provide a counterpoint, and those are fun discussions on the floor of the GA. As long as everybody's, you know, maintaining decorum, they're fun. Yes. If they're not maintaining decorum, it gets tense.
Well, goodness. So you can see, we can anticipate and how over the years, trying to remain grassroots, yet at the same time growing and dealing with various cases is going to put great strain on the assembly. Mm-hmm. How did this develop? Maybe Scott, you can provide us some of the history and eventually bringing us, what were the tremors that eventually gave way to the, I don't want to put a bad spin on it, but what were the events that came up to finally create the SJC?
Yeah, so I give more of the historical details and working through the minutes in my article. But I think as you look at the development of the SJC and some of the theological, cultural, social, practical, polity issues that kind of led to its development, there are really two inflection points that you need to look at. First is 1973, when you've got the formation of the denomination. And then the other is the denomination roughly from like 1981, which Zach has mentioned, up to 1988. In the first inflection point, the denomination is developing in response to the mother church that it came out of.
Yeah.
And so you see in Morton Smith's How Has the Gold Become Dim, many of the sermons and pamphlets of the Concerned Presbyterians, Presbyterian Churchmen United, various groups that were involved, a great deal of concern about the state of the mother church not being able to uphold orthodoxy or godly living. And as the denomination was formed in 1973, they wanted to make sure that as they were forming a new denomination, not only that they were faithful to the gospel, serious for the Great Commission, serious for the Reformed faith, but they would actually be able to maintain that. Because as they were looking back at the old Southern Presbyterian Church, it began wonderfully. But even as early as the 1920s, you began to see discipline break down. And so kind of the first inflection point, the nascent men who became the founding fathers of the PCA were really responding to E.T. Thompson, a famous Presbyterian churchman, historian, and someone who really leveraged the mechanisms of the denomination in the PCUS to suppress the conservative and confessional movement. And so as they began looking at their book of discipline, and particularly the rules of discipline as it's known in the PCA, they didn't just take the current edition of the PCUS rules of discipline. They went back to the 30s thinking that's before the more liberal influences came in. Mm-hmm. And so they were very concerned to make sure that each session, each presbytery, and the denomination as a whole at the General Assembly level was able to do discipline. And that's where you get what's now one of the more kind of important but also controversial features of PCA polity, mm-hmm. in that when the denomination was founded, they created a rule that eventually became BCO 34-1 that gave presbyteries the right to overture the General Assembly and ask that the Assembly assume original jurisdiction over a minister if his presbytery would refuse or fail to act. So you see, there's a concern about doing discipline, and mostly for the first 10 to 13 years, when a case came up, it was handled by the assembly at the assembly. And so the first judicial case that came up was a complaint against Presbytery in California that they had conducted important business in the absence of a quorum, knowingly doing so. And so Morton Smith recommends that this be referred to a committee, and they come back and say, well, this is moot because they actually fixed the problem. But that was the pattern of how it was dealt with. The second inflection point that you find is in the 80s. And really, you find two things going on. Mm-hmm. You find the joining and receiving with the RPCES, which mm-hmm. was a sister denomination at the time, a conservative Presbyterian denomination. But unlike the PCUS, it came from the Northern Presbyterian tradition, not the Southern.
We were lumped in with that too, but we weren't received at the time. So just people know this. But
well,
go ahead.
T.G. Hart gets into that in his article. We had multiple attempts at merger with the OPC. And one time the PCA said no, and the other time the OPC said no.
I think two times the PCA said no. But then, we're definitely the last one. You tried us on our 50th anniversary, and denominational fervor was never higher. And so and that's the bad year to ask. You should ask the year before, the year later.
Right. Anyway. That's always how that works in Presbyterianism. It's always not the right year. And you find that out after the fact.
Well, interestingly, the RPCES, in a way, comes out of the OPC because it comes out of the Bible Presbyterian Church,
right.
Columbus Synod, which had come out of the Bible Presbyterian Church, which came out of the OPC. And that BPC Columbus Synod had merged with the Reformed Presbyterian Church. Was it Evangelical Presbyterian Church? Is that what it was called?
Yeah, it was from the Covenanter line.
Yeah, the Covenanter line. So it was kind of a Scottish and Northern Presbyterian blend denomination, which then was received into our Southern Zion, into the Southern Presbyterian Church.
Which in its tradition is more comfortable with top-down sort of mechanisms, but also, whereas the founders of the PCA were responding to E.T. Thompson, I think it's pretty fair to say that the guys in the RPCES were responding to Carl McIntyre. And a concern, as you see Francis Schaeffer talking about later in life, some of the legalistic excesses. So you had them joining, and then you also have the men who are now at the 10th year of the history of the PCA. So we're out of the founding period, and we're now trying to figure out who we are as we're continuing to grow. And the concern is that the number not only of discipline cases, but other matters before the assembly made it unwieldy to try to do everything directly. And that's where conversations come up, beginning in the 13th General Assembly after joining and receiving. How are we going to handle this? We've now brought in 30 plus thousand new members, a whole new group of churches. We're bigger than we've ever been. We've got more business in every direction than we can handle. And so they appointed a committee comprised of roughly half PCA guys and half former RPCES gentlemen, and they had a broad sweeping mandate to look at everything in the denomination, including one of the recommendations they brought was considering replacing Robert's Rules of Order with something very simple. So it was a wide-ranging committee, and that committee ends up looking at the judicial process and recommending, very controversially at the time, that they erect a permanent judicial commission, and that would then be a new way of doing discipline. But that's how you get from the founding, responding to the liberalism and top-down abuse of power in the former mother denomination, to a new scene in the 80s when a new conversation about discipline in the life of the denomination is possible because they have a different set of concerns that they're trying to navigate.
It's like a new wave in the 80s?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Camden and I are both guitarists.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
That was an era.
We got a new wave. It was definitely an era, man.
Yeah. Then Billy Joel, he's in the news because he's got a new song, but he has a... it's still rock and roll to me. That's his commentary on the new wave, right?
Yeah,
Elvis Costello and all that was going on at the time. Anyway, that's a bonus. We talk historical theology. We could talk rock and roll, the historical lessons.
Whatever. Most excellent dudes.
and I think that's a good metaphor for it because as you see that committee bringing its recommendations, it was clearly seen by the denomination as a new wave, like totally something radically different.
Yeah.
And that's where the conversation begins in the early 80s at the 13th Assembly, but you don't find anything like a finished product until the end of the 80s in 87, 88, 89, because it was so controversial as the denomination was trying to grapple with this proposal of a body that would not allow for, the initial proposal was, there would be no deliberation at the Assembly. And there would be no real review of judicial cases so that the original formulation was not what we have today, where it would be a permanent judicial commission that could appoint regional commissions in between the General Assembly and the presbyteries that would handle the cases. And there might be some appeal to the permanent judicial commission if the regional commissions made up of presbyters from neighboring presbyteries from whence the case arises. But there was really no mechanism for the General Assembly saying, well, wait, we disagree with this decision. And so it was very controversial when it came to the floor. It was a new wave totally for what PCA polity had been up to that point.
Goodness. So what were some of the, maybe who were some of the voices, but at least if not names mentioned, what were some of the arguments for and against it? How was this being presented, and was that deliberated for several years?
So as you look at the Committee on Recommendations for Restructuring the Denomination and those who were for it and opposed to it, you really see a list of who's who in the denomination at the time. You had men like Ruling Elder Chuning, who is a former moderator of the RPCES and then to be a future moderator of the PCA. You had Frank and Will Barker, you had Morton Smith, you had all sorts of men, George Knight, who ended up serving in the OPC, but at the time was in the PCA. And what you saw going on was the committee came and said, in a fairly strong term, that they sensed that from the judicial standpoint of their charge, what they're to look at, the denomination was struggling with ineptitude in the lower courts, legalism, and problems that needed to be addressed. And so they said, we believe this new system of a permanent judicial commission would help alleviate this. When that came to the Assembly, it was very controversial. It took a couple of times of working through it, and what eventually ended up happening was the recommendations regarding the judicial part of the recommendations was referred back to the committee. The committee was allowed to continue for a year, but the Assembly actually tasked Morton Smith, the stated clerk, with adding four new members to the committee to bring a balance, it seems. It's not explicitly stated, but what you can kind of read between the lines is to bring people who are opposed to this idea to the table for the conversation. And if you're at all familiar with Presbyterian polity, you know that traditionally, if a committee is continued, usually its composition, if it's an ad hoc committee, is not radically restructured. And if it is, it's the moderator who does this, but the Assembly tasked the stated clerk with adding four new men, which really was a signal from the denomination, we are not happy with this, and we want other voices sitting at the table as you work this out. And there were many years where they kept bringing back recommendations, but there would be minority reports.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the arguments from the minority reports were saying, this is not Presbyterian. How can presbyteries or a General Assembly not have the right to deliberate over judicial matters? How can this be in keeping with our concern that we maintain the third mark of the church by the different courts exercising proper review and control? One very interesting argument that they made was that if the concern is over legalism or ineptitude, how is this proposal of a permanent judicial commission going to address those issues? There are more fundamental issues here. Now, they said, we don't agree with that. But if that's true, even these proposals are not going to address the problems that are in front of us. And so you saw some arguing basically that we need kind of a group of men really dedicated to doing this at the assembly level who could take the burden off of the assembly, while others arguing, no, this is essential to the operation of the church court. And what ended up happening was a compromise where a standing judicial commission was formulated, but there were mechanisms for presbyteries having rights, not having to do it by way of commission when they did judicial cases, and having mechanisms for review and control for people being able to file minority reports and the assembly being able to vote up or down on it. But interestingly, the piece about the assembly deliberating was something that never manifested, because to this day in the PCA, we don't vote to approve the actions of the Standing Judicial Commission. We only deliberate them if there's a minority report that comes to the floor. And so there's not a deliberation over all the cases that come.
So the SJC might issue a minority report, and then that triggers certain things.
Right, and then that would come to the floor for approval. And then, you know, the majority opinion can be sustained or the minority report can be sustained. You can do different things with it at that point. Right. But at every year, there's basically a report from the Standing Judicial Commission as to what they did on behalf of the assembly, but there's no deliberation over it.
There's also a review of their minutes by the Committee on Constitutional Business. And, oh man, things got fun at the 50th GA. I mean, we were trying to figure out, is it in order, according to our rules, for a minority report from the CCB to come to the floor and then be discussed by the assembly?
Mm.
Well, why would a minority report from the CCB come to the floor regarding the minutes of the SJC?
Yeah.
Well, because there would be a majority opinion that the minutes are in order, but a minority report that no, they're not in order. But we don't have a mechanism that's clearly articulated to receive that minority report and then to deliberate about it. And so, you know, these are things in our polity that we're trying to work out. Yeah. But, you know, something I want to mention, just to give a bit of bigger picture, Scott's granular analysis here is so helpful and is right spot on. And he's not missing anything. But one of the dynamics in the PCA, when the RPCS comes in, it's a major deal because it gives us national reach, gives us two educational institutions. Mm-hmm. At the same time, the PCUS and the PCUSA have merged together. And so that's a big thing. So in the PCA, we're looking at the mainline denomination with millions of members. I think around 3 million members in the mainline denomination.
4.5 at its max, maybe a few years later.
But And so the men in the PCA, desiring to be obedient to the Great Commission, actually task the stated clerk and Covenant Seminary to produce a report on how many ministers we would need to produce to backfill anticipated vacancies, to plant new churches, and whatever else it takes to get to a million members by the millennium.
Right.
Now, the PCA did not reach a million members by the millennium, but I mentioned this in my article because it stuck out to me.
Mm.
Man, that's admirable. Mm. I mean, they really desired not just to be the big man on campus, but to be faithful to and obedient to the Great Commission and to figure out, okay, what do we need to do to continue the remarkable growth we've had and to move it from being transfer growth out of the mainline church and welcoming the RPCS to be not transfer growth, but to be real, you know, conversion growth, we might call it. And so that, I think that's part of the burden of the assembly. As they're getting bogged down in discipline cases, they say, we need to uphold order in the church. We need to practice review and control of the lower courts. That's part of the General Assembly's responsibility. At the same time, man, we really want to get after it in terms of church planting and extending the kingdom, which is also part of the task of the church as a sending agency, because the church is the sending agency. You know, it's a church that sends missionaries, as we've been hearing today, this week at the conference, at Greenville Seminary. And so there's this real tension of wanting to be careful and thorough and practicing review and control, but just saying we only have so many hours in a general assembly. And we can't handle, you know, everything at the granular level. And so, you know, I think I might have some things that would pass as documentary evidence for that claim, but that's at least my sense, is there's a real desire, and that desire is knit into the fabric of the PCA as a Southern Presbyterian church, to reach the nations with the gospel of Jesus Christ, to proclaim Christ crucified to the ends of the earth, and also to review these thorny discipline cases, which just really do consume our attention, and rightfully so, because they need to be handled.
And you know, I think you're absolutely right on that score. And one thing that, looking from that time period when the denomination was discussing those issues of how can we reach for a million, how can we plant more churches, one conversation was had that I think would have facilitated that in a greater measure, and one was not had. The one that was had was a conversation over delegated assembly.
Yep.
And really, I think you see the PCA kind of looking back to its PCUS heritage and looking to its side with the mainline and wanting, and I think with a godly zeal of good ambition, to grow and to continue to reach the lost and continue to build up the church. But there were positive conversations about a delegated assembly, but you can't realistically, as you were saying about the OPC, with the size of the denomination, unless you go to something like a delegated assembly, you're not going to have the ability or the bandwidth to handle all that business. Or another option that's a historic Presbyterian one would be to have synods.
Right.
And that's where, if you look at the PCUS and even the PCUSA, they have synods, they have delegation, and that would have probably facilitated, without having to go to a standing judicial commission or some of the other things that we've had to do. But the denomination was not willing to do that. And I'm sensing that's because of the grassroots. We want as many guys from different presbyteries and the churches to be represented at the General Assembly every year, which is great, but there's a trade-off with that in terms of what you can do from a polity bandwidth.
And more cynically, I think the convention feel of the assembly is self-perpetuating.
Yeah.
I mean, there really is an incentive to have like a trade show for confessional Presbyterians every year, and the PCA's General Assembly is the only thing that even begins to approach the feel of a confessional Presbyterian trade show.
Exactly.
And I say that as one who loves it. I mean, I have so much fun. I would go to GA every day of the week if I could.
Yeah.
It's probably good. It's not in session every day of the week.
Probably.
Yeah, there's more to it than there's a whole other structure around it, and there are so many reasons people go, and people like me are there that I wouldn't be there, not being sent as a fraternal delegate. I might come once or twice to go visit, but I'm there because we're exhibiting on behalf of Reform Forum, and if it didn't have that feel or that purpose, there wouldn't be as many people there. There are other reasons. It's become more than merely a parliamentary body, a court of the church, even though that is essentially what the whole purpose of this meeting, but there are tangential purposes.
So I've been to so many different denominations assemblies, and the Bible Pres and the ARP, those are family reunions. The OPC is a business meeting, and the PCA is a convention or a trade show.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is. And I mean, there's, you know, warm reunions at all of them. But I got a question for you.
Yeah.
You mentioned, you know, short of being a fraternal delegate, is Chad Van Dixhorn like the permanent commissioned church worker of the OPC that's set aside and apart and consecrated unto being the fraternal delegate to the PCA?
So. I think there was some secret commission of some sort. You might have to talk to Professor Curto, Dr. Curto, because he serves, if I'm not mistaken, as the chair of our committee for
interchurch relations,
ecumenicity and interchurch relations. So Chad is a member of that committee. So it's always a member of the committee that is assigned to you know, be a fraternal delegate to one of these other.
He does a great job. He is the only OPC minister that I mentioned by name in my article because of his comment where he introduced himself as a commissioned church worker, the OPC, the year we received the,
he loves that. Hand
the,
it up.
Yeah, oh man, it was great.
But the way that that works also is ecumenicity and interchurch relations, as Tony, Dr. Curto was mentioning to me even last night or reminding me, it's a long game. It's not a game, but you get what I'm saying? Like, it's a long play and you're building relationships. So
OPC does a great job of it.
We hope to. We take it very seriously. There's a history to that. But it's perhaps better to build those relationships long term. And so you have... generally, rather than mixing it up and sending a new guy every year, well, there might be advantages to that. But if we send the same person and they're developing relationships and they're a good representative, they're not just seeking to report only the things they like and only bring back, you know, you don't want people filtering the information, but we elect good members of our committee. The tendency is until such person is not reelected to the committee or they decide to roll off of it, I would imagine Dr. Van Dixhorn will be coming to your assemblies for quite some time.
You know, my fear is, Camden, that there may be some in the PCA that think he's the only minister of the OPC.
We could do worse.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. I had to do it. I know your listeners
might,
love that.
That might not be bad. Then you know, who knows the alternative? I don't know.
He does a great job representing the OPC.
He does. Yeah, I always appreciate his reports.
My little barb, though, it'd be nice if you actually allowed us to appear or allowed the delegates to actually address the assembly. I know there are reasons for that too. Mm-hmm. You know, people got to go to their parties and dinners at night, but so we don't have time to see you face to face. You have to submit your video. But honestly, though, we appreciate the opportunity to address the assembly. And
you know, the PCA has an unenviable position of being not just the largest denomination in NAEPARC, but larger than the rest of NAEPARC combined.
Right.
And
just led some to think we should just leave it all together.
Well, there are some, and thankfully our commitments in NAEPARC have strengthened over the last few years. And as we've left the National Association of Evangelicals, which we had no business being a part of.
That's right.
At least for the last several years.
Right.
And, but you know, when you're the big, like 800-pound gorilla in a room, you got a big target on your back in a certain sense, or there's a danger of that. But what I found is the men who come and represent our sister denominations treat the PCA with respect and appreciation that they would expect us to do in their assemblies. And I know Brad Isbell did a great job at the OPC assembly the other year. And I always love to hear from our brothers in the ARP and the OPC and the RPCNA. And man, there was a delegate from one of our, from a Korean language denomination who just really exhorted us to maintain faithfulness in the area of biblical sexuality when we were dealing with all the Revoice stuff.
Yep.
And we need those voices there because we need to be reminded that we occupy a place as the PCA. The PCA occupies a place of significance in the Reformed world, and that carries with it great responsibility.
Amen. No, it's very much appreciated. We love being connected. We love to hear the details of how each expression of Christ Church, even within the confessional Presbyterian orbit, operates slightly differently and comes from different history and has their own particular emphases, but how we still all are part of the same body of Christ and, in service of his kingdom. In our remaining time, why don't we highlight a few things? Let's move some copies of the Confessional Presbyterian, but what are some things, Zach that or Scott, that we'd like to feature and let people know? I mean, we could just even read the table of contents, but is there anything that you would like to highlight as people might want to subscribe or order their copies?
What other journal is there that would have back-to-back articles by D.G. Hart and Zachary Garris dealing with ecumenicity? I mean, and both articles are excellent. Excellent. Both men did a really good job with it. D.G. Hart wrote, Machen's Other Warrior Children, Conservative Presbyterians in the OPC and PCA, which follows on Sean Morris's fascinating focused biographical sketch, the not-quite-founding father J. Gresham Machen and the origins of the PCA. And then Zach Garris, following Hart's article, Southern Presbyterian Ecumenism, the PCUS-RCA merger plan. There was one, thankfully failed. Northern Reunion and the formation of the PCA. But that was one of the driving reasons for the formation of the PCA is conservatives saw this and said, what is going on? We can't be part of a church that's going to unite itself to clearly apostate denominations. The Northern Presbyterian Church on one hand, the RCA, the Liberal Dutch Reformed Church at the time. And, you know, it's interesting. It parallels the OPC and the CRC's conversations around the same time. You know, very, very interesting. So those are some good pieces. My co-pastor, Dr. Pipa, and my mentor updated his biographical sketch of our first stated clerk, Morton Howison Smith, who also founded Greenville Seminary, first professor at the Reformed Theological Institute, which became RTS Jackson. That's a lovely sketch of a man who is much misunderstood, but greatly significant to the history of Presbyterianism in America, and was always a gentleman. Mm-hmm. And then if you want to read something spicy, Frank Smith's article, Like a Box of Chocolates, Experiencing PCA Worship. Wow. It is a thorough look at the, for better or for worse, diversity of worship in the PCA. And Frank Smith loves that metaphor from Forrest Gump, like a box of chocolates. He actually uses it several times in his book on the history of the PCA, which I noticed. I said, man, he really likes life is like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get. I mean, that's the key. But Frank did a great job on that. And then there are some things that are off the theme that I was reminded this week. Even Carl Robbins, who was my pastor while I was an intern preparing for ministry down here, he said that the article by our friend Colin Dow, who's a minister in the Free Church of Scotland, The Doctrine of the Heavenly Intercession of Christ in the Writings of James Durham, that article is really, really good. Mm-hmm. And it's an oft-neglected doctrine of Christ's heavenly intercession. But Colin takes a close look at how James Durham develops that, and he did a great job in that article. And there are a number of other pieces that I wish I could just go through everything, but I can't. But just this is such a great issue.
It's a great issue.
And I I'm a bit biased.
Yeah. You know? Well, well done.
But well, and if I could say too, you know, I think for those of us in the PCA, this issue will have an immediate attraction. But if you are outside of the PCA, but in NAPARC, in the ARP, in the OPC, the URC, I would argue that the story of the history of the PCA is really a shared story among all of our sister denominations. Because, you know, you look at the figures in here, like, say, Dr. Smith. Well, how many men in the ARP and the OPC and other denominations could say, I or my minister went to RTS, particularly in the critical days when RTS was being founded in the first 20 years. If you look at grappling with issues of discipline or dealing with issues of merger, these are things that are common over the last 50 years to all of our denominations. And I think as you go through it, you know, issues of worship like Frank Smith's article, these are all issues that we're dealing with. And so even if you're outside the PCA, I think you'll find it refreshing to think about these issues that you and your denomination have likely been dealing with, but to hear it in someone else's house and someone else's parlance and to be able to think through it from a different perspective.
Yes.
But these are not issues that are unique to the PCA. The PCA's unique way of dealing with these issues is native to the PCA, but we're all in this together in NAPARC. And so I really think no matter what denomination you're in, if you read through this issue of the journal, you'll find things that speak to you and your particular ministry and denominational context.
I couldn't agree more. We always want to compare notes. This is the value of reading history, but also being involved in ecumenicity and really treating the church the way it ought to be treated, understanding the universality of the church, but then putting all of our efforts into developing relationships around confessional truth and unity. And it's really important. It strengthens others. It strengthens ourselves. It's essential. So where can we find copies of the Confessional Presbyterian Journal? Is it still at cpjournal.com, also at Greenville?
Yeah, great question. Greenville just relaunched its website, and the new website is beautiful.
Yeah,
far, far better than the previous iteration. And I say that as the one who came up with the previous iteration, but you know, the resources at their disposal and the manpower they have are qualitatively different at this point than they were when I was there. And I think that they've just really advanced on the representing the school effectively in the public. It's a beautiful website, not just aesthetically, but also very easy to navigate. There's a link at the bottom in the footer of the website, the Confessional Presbyterian Journal, and that will route you over to where you can order the journal at logcollegepress.com/confessional-presbyterian-journal,
nice.
All conventionally spelled.
Yes.
And you can order the journal there. You'll see the last three issues, which are the three that Greenville Seminary has published, having taken over the journal a couple of years ago. Those are available for purchase at $25 a piece, which, I mean, $25 for a 300...
Oh, it's a huge book.
328-page, you know, high-quality academic, full-color academic journal. Well, full-color shell.
No, it is.
It's black and white interior, but it's a good deal, and you can even subscribe to the journal and get it on an annual basis. And so it's available there. Back issues, so before Volume 17, are still available from cpjournal.com, and Chris Caldwell has that inventory. Some of the issues, I know Volume 1, a couple of the others are out of print at this point, but someone asked me, where can I find Volume 1?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, trying to find, you know,
I think I have
treasure.
The whole set.
I have a whole set. I found Volume 1 in a bundle on eBay after looking for a while. I have a friend that was keeping an eye out for me, too, a man who is near and dear to my heart, Wayne Sparkman, who's one of our associate editors, and our historian in the BCA. And so, you know, it's hard to find some of those, but Chris still has many of the back issues, and we have these last three, one with a young Bavinck on the cover, another one with R.L. Dabney, very controversial figure on the cover, and now this one with a scene from the first GA.
This, I think the Dabney one smokes. I think when you open it.
Well, we put in big bold print on the front, Reckoning with Dabney, an American Presbyterian. And this is something that I think, and you as a historian of American Presbyterianism will appreciate this, we tend, because of our unique trauma of the war between the states, we tend to think in terms of Northern Presbyterians and Southern Presbyterians. But what we need to remind ourselves is before 1861, there were American Presbyterians, and they were in conversation with one another, with influence on one another that crossed the Mason-Dixon line, or however you want to put it. And Dabney is a Southern Presbyterian. I mean, it would be foolish to throw away that category. But he's an American Presbyterian, and that look at him is an important one to make. So that issue's good. I enjoyed reading and editing that, but the PCA issue has been just a thrill to be a part of. And this year we're gonna have William Perkins on the cover.
Nice.
I already have a number of articles lined up. I have the biographical sketch anchor piece lined up with somebody who's a Perkins scholar, and I have several from men who are doing their PhD in Puritan theology and Perkins. And I need to approach a couple other men that I have in mind. Really excited about that. Can't wait to see the portrait Mike puts together, but also the articles that are contributed. And one last parting word. Pick up the Confessional Presbyterian and read it.
Yes.
But as you read this volume, you know, it's obviously themed on the PCA. We've been talking about that for like an hour and a half or more at this point. I don't know. Our motto is faithful to the scriptures, true to the Reformed faith, obedient to the Great Commission. And we tend to trifurcate that motto and say some churches are really good at this aspect or the other aspect. I get that. But as you read these articles, think about this. In order to uphold strength in any of the three, you need to have all three together. You can't separate biblical fidelity from obedience to the Great Commission, because guess where the Great Commission is? It's in the Bible. And so if you're going to be faithful to the Bible, you need to be obedient to the Great Commission. To be obedient to the Great Commission, you need to know your Bible. And we as confessional Presbyterians and Reformed believers believe that the Reformed faith is the best expression, the clearest, most biblically faithful expression of the Christian religion, of the Christian faith, of Great Commission Christianity. And so they all go together. And that's a point I make toward the end of my article, and it's made in various ways throughout the journal. Let's not silo out these three inextricably linked values that really do, I believe, define the Presbyterian Church in America at her best.
Amen. Yes. Mm-hmm. We'll have links in the episode description to this particular issue, but also the journal more generally, and to Greenville Presbyterian Theological Seminary. Well, again, we're very thankful to them for hosting us, for allowing us to be part of a pre-conference event, and to be here at Heritage Bible Church in Greer for the annual conference. Please check the conference out. Next year, we'll be looking at pastors and pastoral theology, most specifically in 2025, and you'll definitely want to come, and hopefully we'll be back. We fully intend to be. And we can meet you there, but there's a lot going on. Check us out online at reformedforum.org. But Zach and Scott, thanks so much for joining us today. It was really a pleasure. Let's keep the conversation going, but off microphone.
Thanks, Cameron.
All right.
Thanks,
great
Cameron.
To have
it
you
was
guys.
A delight.
We'd love for you to continue and learn more about what we have on offer. But I do want to thank everybody for listening and watching, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.